This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro, and each night we're here to answer your questions.
Hi, this is Heather from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
My name is Laura Amtower, and I live in Detroit, Michigan.
This is Natalie calling from Florida, and I have three questions for you tonight.
I'm wondering how the coronavirus pandemic will end, and what is the exact stopping point?
I have a question about bringing my college student back from campus.
What is happening in China? If memory serves, they were the first country to become impacted by COVID-19.
Thank you.
Thanks, and I love the show.
Tonight, NPR journalists and outside experts are with us to offer some solid facts, tell you what we know, and correct some of the misinformation that is floating around. And when we don't know something, we'll tell you that too. Send us your questions about the pandemic and the way we live now at npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. Each night, we begin the national conversation by answering the question, what happened today? Well, around the world, there are now nearly 2 million confirmed infections, with nearly 600,000 in the U.S. States are joining forces. Governors from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Massachusetts will collaborate on a working group. They'll gather scientific advice to decide when their states can reopen. Here's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
I believe the worst is over if we continue to be smart. And I believe we can now start on the path to normalcy.
The governors of California, Washington, and Oregon formed a similar group. President Trump said tonight he has the authority to overrule governors' decisions.
We have local government that hopefully will do a good job. And if they don't do a good job, I'd step in so fast. But no, they can't do anything without the approval of the President of the United States.
At the same time, the World Health Organization warned countries against lifting restrictions too quickly.
While COVID-19 accelerates very fast, it decelerates much more slowly.
A Navy sailor who was on the USS Theodore Roosevelt has died from COVID-19. The virus spread quickly on the aircraft carrier. Its commander was replaced after he raised the alarm outside the chain of command. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was released from the hospital yesterday after a stay in the ICU, and he is now recovering from the virus at his country estate.
I want to pay my own thanks to the utterly brilliant doctors who took some crucial decisions a few days ago, for which I will be grateful for the rest of my life.
Well, joining us now to answer your questions about the federal government's response is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
Tonight, the White House briefing was pretty extraordinary. The president was combative and defensive. Tell us what happened.
It really was striking, even for this president, who is always up for a fight with the press. But really, for the first 30 minutes or so, there were no updates about the coronavirus deaths or the status of protective equipment deliveries. It was just a full-on defense by the president, making the case that the administration moved quickly and made all the right decisions when it came to the virus. Trump even played this campaign-style video with selective clips highlighting his action on the coronavirus and positive things that governors have said about him. And this was all in response to various news reports that have said and reported that Trump was slow to act.
Let's go to our listener questions. Our first one here comes from Marsha in Chicago.
I heard that President Trump plans to send PPE and ventilators to other countries. Is this correct? And if so, does this mean that the United States and the states have all they need?
Aisha, is President Trump planning to send personal protective equipment to other countries?
He has said this. Usually he makes these type of remarks when he's, making this argument that the government has done a good job getting equipment and ventilators to the states. He argues that the U.S. is oversupplied in some areas and can help fill other countries' gaps. But while some states like California have been able to send ventilators to other states where there is more need, we know that on the ground, there are still a lot of calls for protective equipment, for masks, tests, all these things. None of those things are universally available in the U.S. at this moment. And we've heard over and over again complaints from health officials and governors saying that the administration has not stepped up to the plate and filled a lot of these needs.
I also want to ask you about something really extraordinary the president said at tonight's briefing. He said, when someone is president of the United States, the authority is total. He was talking about what he believes is his ability to override governors, but that's not how the Constitution works. Fact check this for us.
It is simply not true. So even as president, even as the president asserted that he has total power, that is not in line with the Constitution. Trump tellingly could not say where he would get this authority. He said the administration would maybe write some papers on it. And the Vice President Pence seemed to argue that because this is an extraordinary emergency, then the president has really extraordinary and possibly, I guess, unlimited powers. But that's just not the case. Trump did not issue stay-at-home orders, and he has not broadly used the Defense Production Act and other powers that he does have to compel distribution of equipment. But it seems like when it comes to this idea of having like a grand reopening of the economy, he wants ownership of that. He wants to be able to say he did it. But that's just not how this country is set up.
NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to check in on the global fight against the pandemic. Later in the program, we'll answer your questions about how China is opening up again, as well as the rise of COVID-19 in Africa and Latin America. But first to Europe with NPR Global Health and Development correspondent Jason Beaubien. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Ari.
Let's begin with Italy, one of the hardest hit countries in Europe. This question comes from Tanya in Massachusetts.
Why were Italians disproportionately affected by the coronavirus? Italy had the highest death rates in the world due to COVID-19.
In so many countries, we've seen death rates differ. And tell us what's behind this. Was there something about Italy in particular?
It is difficult to compare death rates right now. While you've got so many countries are still battling the virus, they're in different stages of how they're fighting it, of how early it came on. You know, Italy has the highest case fatality rate in the world, but if you actually look at deaths per capita, deaths like say per 100,000 people, Spain actually has the highest death rate from COVID-19 right now, and Belgium's death rate per 100,000 is almost exactly the same as Italy. But there has been a lot of attention on Italy. And, it's a reasonable question. Why was Italy seemingly so much harder hit than other countries? You know, Italy has an older population. It's clear that this disease affects older people much harder than it does younger people. Also, rates of smoking in Italy are higher than some other European countries. So there are individual national factors that affect how this outbreak plays out. I do think it's going to take a bit more time to see if the experience elsewhere is that much different from Italy.
All right, from Italy, let's move to Germany. Here's another question about mortality rates. This question comes from Ruth in Longmont, Colorado.
Why is the apparent death rate in Germany so much lower than the apparent death rate in Italy or Iran? Does this mean Germany has done a lot more testing? If so, does it mean the real death rate of deaths to all cases is much lower than 3%, perhaps 10 times lower?
It's an interesting question. To know what the death rate is, you have to know how many people have the disease. And if some people are asymptomatic, right, it seems like the number could change depending on how many tests you do.
Right. And she's definitely onto something that this is about testing. You know, Germany has tested more people than any other country in Europe. It's twice as many tests as Spain has run, four times as many as the UK or France. So basically, Germany has found more cases. They've found mild cases that might never even gotten picked up. These are people who might, if they'd been in Italy, never even would have gotten tested, never would have gotten counted in the Italian numbers. But these cases are in the German data. It's interesting. Actually, if you look at Germany versus the Netherlands, they both have recorded about 3,000 deaths. Germany, however, has done 10 times the amount of testing as the Netherlands and found more than 100,000 cases. So if you look at the case fatality rates, you know, it's about 3% in Germany. Holland right now has about 26,000 cases. So the case fatality rate in the Netherlands would be close to 10%. You know, it's very unlikely that this virus behaves differently, plays out that differently in these two high-income European neighbors. It really probably is a function of the testing and having this larger denominator in places that, like Germany, that have tested much more aggressively.
That's really interesting and some helpful basic math there. Let's turn to Britain because the Prime Minister, as we've heard, was released from the ICU, from the hospital. That's good news. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, the UK is really struggling right now, right?
It really is interesting looking at Europe at the moment. lately most cases in Europe. And I mean, right now, the UK has the most new cases per day in Europe, second only to the US globally. And when you look at other European countries and you look at that curve of what's happening with their new cases, most other European countries look like they're plateauing, they're kind of coming down the other side. And you look at the UK and their curve is still going up, and it's still going up quite sharply.
Finally, just briefly in our last minute, we have a question about Spain, where the lockdown was very strict. Parts of that lockdown have started lifting today. What are we seeing there right now?
So you're seeing what so many other countries want to do. They want to be able to get out of this. And Spain is attempting to do this. They've had incredibly strict rules there. I mean, there are places where you couldn't even go out for a walk if you didn't have a dog to be walking in some places. Police were patrolling. They were finding violators. But now Spain is trying to figure out how to back off. So this week, they're allowing manufacturers, people in the construction trade to start working. You know, they're not opening up all the restaurants and the bars again, but they're sort of slowly trying to ease back in to getting some people back into the workforce.
Okay, we're going to hear a lot more from NPR's Jason Beaubien later in the program. Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
And you can hear much more of our coverage when you download the NPR One app. Go to the Explore tab and click on the coronavirus outbreak for a curated stream of stories. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. There are now nearly 600,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States. To get this pandemic under control, we will have to slow the spread of the virus. And you've asked us a lot of questions about how to do that. Dr. Tina Chopra is here with answers. She's professor of infectious diseases at Wayne State University, and she's also corporate medical director of infection prevention and hospital epidemiology at the Detroit Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Chopra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First, let me just ask you about what's happening in Detroit. It's one of the hardest hit cities in the U.S. right now. Nearly 1,500 people in Michigan have died, many of them in the Detroit area. Can you just tell us what it's like inside the hospital rooms these days?
Sure. I think we were on an exponential phase until last 2 days, where we are seeing a little bit of decline, which could also mean a lack of enough testing because of the weekend, but we are seeing some glimmers of hope now, and our EDs are looking way better than last week. We are seeing lesser cases, but yes, we are seeing more mortalities because, as you know, the death rate is always lagging behind.
Right.
And so we are still seeing more mortalities, but the hope is that over the next week or so, we will truly start seeing a decline.
Okay, so more people dying, but fewer reported infections, which could be a good sign. Let's go to our listeners. And the first listener question comes from Pamela, who is in the Detroit area.
There are some states that are showing low numbers of cases. And I'm wondering if that relative to the number of test kits that they've been given, and is there a way to find out how many have been conducted per state?
This is something you alluded to in which we were just talking about earlier with regards to European countries. Do you think the low infection rates we're seeing reported have to do with the number of tests that have been administered in each state?
Yes, I think the testing is extremely important in any kind of pandemic, and the number of tests performed really help us determine the extent of disease and the epidemiology of disease. And also, if you are seeing that in a particular city or county or state there are more positive tests than negatives, that means, and there's more mortality, the case fatality rate is high, that means that we are not testing enough, and that's why of the tests that we performed, more are positive. So really the denominator is very, very important. And again, I can't stress the importance of testing more during pandemic so you can really understand the burden of disease.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a couple of different questions about how the virus spreads through the air specifically. One listener wrote to ask if an industrial fan could increase or decrease the chances of transmission in places where essential work is being performed. And another listener, Jessica in Philadelphia, had a similar question, but about fresh air and breezes.
I live in a densely populated urban area. Should I keep the windows open for fresh air as the weather gets nicer? Or does the latest CDC guidance about the distance of transmission change that?
Dr. Chopra, whether we're talking about an industrial fan in a warehouse or a breeze in a dense urban environment, does this make spread more or less likely?
So the industrial fan issue is one. I mean, if you are in an area, there's an industrial fan and somebody's coughing or sneezing, definitely there is more chance of aerosolization.
And so that could be a risk.
Droplets, yeah, so that would be a risk. But if you're talking about breathing fresh air and there's nobody around and you're breathing fresh air, there shouldn't be any risk.
Okay, so maybe she can leave the window open to get a breeze in. If you have a question for Dr. Chopra, send it to us at npr.org/nationalconversation or share it on Twitter using the hashtag NPRConversation. And Dr. Chopra, our next question is about how to destroy the virus.
My name is Cheryl Bartz, and I live in northern Michigan. From what I've read, viruses are non-living. If they're not living, how can they be killed? And what causes a virus to be non-viable if it sits on a surface for more than 72 hours?
Dr. Chopra, are viruses alive? Do they actually get killed? Explain this for us.
So a virus always needs a cell to replicate. So it cannot really cause disease without coming in contact with a live cell, which is whether it is an animal or a human cell. Whereas this virus and even flu virus can last on surfaces for several hours, it can remain viable. And that's why the importance of cleaning surfaces and the importance of disinfecting, whether you are in your house or you are in the hospital environment. So you need about 60% alcohol to kill the virus, to make it non-viable so that it cannot infect your cells and come onto your body or mucous membranes and infect your cells. So it always needs a cell to replicate, and that's the whole life cycle of a virus.
So even though we use the phrases alive or killed, we're actually talking about viability or non-viability. It's not actually a living thing.
That's correct.
Okay, well, our next question here comes from Laura, who wants to know what the end of this looks like on a larger scale.
I'm wondering how the coronavirus pandemic will end and what is the exact stopping point.
Dr. Chopra, what does the last chapter of this story look like?
So this virus pandemic has five phases to it. We are in the phase two. So first phase was containment. We couldn't contain the virus. It already spread. We are in the mitigation phase of the virus. And after this, the third phase is when we are going to start seeing a true decline in the epidemic curve, and we are going to slowly open different businesses. And that's when we need to really maintain our social distancing, maintain all the rules and regulations we've learned so far, including hand washing and environmental cleaning of public spaces. And then in the fourth phase, we will see that the vaccine is here, and we are going to develop, not only a large population is going to actually recover from the virus, and the vaccine is going to be successful and available to us. The combination of the vaccine and the herd immunity that will be acquired through getting infected and getting recovered from it will help end the pandemic. But until then, the virus is not going to magically disappear, and it will have a seasonal appearance, and it will come back most likely in the fall along with flu. The last and the fifth stage of the virus is of the pandemic is, to, so to speak, that when we need to be as a nation united and ready to be prepared for the next pandemic that we can face.
So the five phases, just to review: containment, mitigation, which is where we are now, decline, vaccination, and then preparation for the next one, because this isn't going to be the last one, you're saying.
That's right.
Dr. Tina Chopra, thank you so much for answering these questions for us today.
Thank you.
She's a professor of infectious diseases at Wayne State University. And if you have questions, we want to help. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation or on Twitter, ask your question using the hashtag NPRConversation. We're going to take a short break. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. No one knows exactly what a return to normal life will look like, especially here in the U.S., where each state is more or less making up its own rules. One place that's beginning to take a few steps back to normalcy is the country where the coronavirus outbreak began, China. In this part of the program, we'll answer your questions about what life is like today in China and other countries that are dealing with COVID-19. In a minute, we'll hear about other countries in Latin America and Asia. First, let's start with NPR's Emily Feng in Wuhan, China. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
Hi, good to have you with us. Let's just dive right in with this question from Natalie Preston in Florida.
What is happening in China? I understand that they are now in a position to where they are doing better and maybe coming out of the social distancing and having to isolate at home. So how are they doing it?
Emily, you've been doing some great reporting in the city where the coronavirus was first identified. What is daily life like there?
It is, and I'm happy to report returning back to normal, but in stages. So Natalie asked about social distancing. Social distancing is still very much in force in the city, and people do it without being asked at this point. It's just habit. So If there are lines, people naturally stand 1 meter apart. Everyone still goes out with a mask. It's quite common to see people wearing goggles, gloves, full protective gear, even if they're just going for a walk in the park or going grocery shopping. Wow. So that kind of personal protection is still very common. I think what Natalie is referring to are these lockdown measures, these quarantine policies that were put in place across the country. Those have lifted in some part in Wuhan, the city that I am, but that doesn't mean other cities have lifted their measures. In Beijing, where I normally am based, restrictions there are actually tightening because of the concern of imported cases, travelers who are bringing the virus with them back into the country. And all of this loosening is happening even in Wuhan with extensive digital contact tracing. So people are going around with these government-sanctioned apps that show if they've had recent contact with a sick person or an infected area. And if your app turns a certain color, you will not be allowed into a public space like a grocery store.
Oh, interesting. I know there's a fear that as social distancing rules let up and the lockdown decreases, that there could be a second spike in cases. Is there any evidence or fear of that in Wuhan where you are?
There very much is. Doctors here that I've spoken to, directors at hospitals say they're not letting their guard down and they're preparing for a possible second wave this fall. They have not totally dismantled all of these makeshift field hospitals that they built in the city because they're preparing for a second wave and there's still extensive testing going on, even though that's not free anymore. People pay out of pocket for that.
Let's go to another listener question.
I'm Stephen Stolzberg. I live in Portland, Oregon. China is saying that the virus is not spreading anymore. However, it seems unlikely that 1 billion people have developed herd immunity and that there are no carriers traveling around the country. What do you think?
Emily, how trustworthy is the information coming out of Beijing right now?
There are significant reasons to take the statistics coming out of China with a grain of salt. They've covered up previous epidemics. They've shown themselves very willing to make up other kinds of statistics, mostly economic ones. But on the whole, I think the numbers coming out of China about the new coronavirus, although not perfect, illustrate accurately the trend of what's happening, which is that domestic transmissions have fallen dramatically. But there are still people getting sick in China. And the reason for that is people who are traveling back into the country, getting infected from places like Russia and the U.S. and the U.K. and bringing that illness home and potentially infecting other people. One of the biggest sources of the virus this week has been Russia. China sealed off its land border in response, and they've actually put a tiny border town next to Russia on lockdown, similar to what they did in Wuhan. So you see, again, they're lifting lockdowns on one city but placing them on another if they see another flare-up. Another big concern about why the numbers may not be completely accurate are these asymptomatic cases. So people who carry the virus can be infectious, but they exhibit no symptoms. So people don't know who to test. It's really hard to find them. China does not include these asymptomatic people in its official case count. It only started disclosing how many they were discovering each day on April 1st. They've never disclosed the total number. So the real question now is how many of these asymptomatic cases are walking around and traveling in China and potentially infecting other people, though officials here in China say that you're required to report yourself if you think or another person is asymptomatic. With regards to herd immunity, doctors here in Wuhan say that is absolutely not a thing. One director at a hospital told me that he tested 3,600 healthy hospital staff in early March, and he found that only 2.4% of them had some kind of antibody resistance to COVID-19. These are people who probably had contact with the virus over the last 3 months, and only 2.4% of them had developed some kind of natural resistance.
Huh. All right, one last question here from Stacey Dufresne of Denver, who wants to know, what lessons can we learn from China's recovery? What do you think, Emily? Is what China is doing right now replicable in the States? Are there lessons that we should be taking from the Chinese?
Well, the first lesson is you cannot have economic activity and social distancing at the same time. China just completely shut down for nearly 2 months, and their quarterly GDP data comes out this Friday. The forecasts for that are negative. They're somewhere between negative 6 and 10%. So China's economy contracted immensely because of their social distancing and quarantines. The second is China has been reopening, but in stages. So it's going to take months in the U.S. And the third is, if you want to open up, you need to have extensive contact tracing to know immediately if there is some kind of flare-up. I mentioned before these government-sanctioned apps. They're clunky. They don't always work. There are definitely privacy issues, but they've been central in getting people back to work quickly.
NPR's Emily Feng in Wuhan, China, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Ari.
And we're joined now once again by NPR's Jason Beaubien, who covers global health for NPR. And Jason, let's stay in Asia for a moment with a listener who writes, can we learn from places such as Hong Kong, where they have only 4 deaths to date? Jason, what has Hong Kong done to keep the death toll so low there?
One thing about Hong Kong is that they dealt with SARS 17 years ago, back in 2003. So when they first heard about this, they really took it very seriously from day one. They moved aggressively to shut down their borders with China. They shut schools. But they did keep a lot of businesses open, including restaurants and shopping malls, mahjong parlors. There was this one guy that I talked to there, this epidemiologist, and he said that question is, do you control the virus or do you control the population in an outbreak like this? And Hong Kong has chosen to try to control the virus so that the population can continue to do things, continue to go out, continue to be able to have some economic activity. So very early on, Hong Kong set up their own tests. Every hospital was able to do its own testing in February. They set up home testing that outpatient clinics could send out. They have really focused on chasing down every case. A health department would have a news conference every night. They talk about what new cases were out there. They would say, if you had any contact with a taxi driver with this license plate, get in touch. They worked aggressively to contain the virus, and they were very willing to mandatorily quarantine people. Thousands, tens of thousands of people were sent into quarantine simply because they were contacts. They didn't have the virus. They never tested positive, but they were ordered into quarantine because they were in contact with someone who was a case.
All right, we need to take a short pause, but if you have a question for Jason Beaubien, tweet it to us with the hashtag NPR Conversation. You're listening to The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. And NPR's Jason Beaubien is still here answering your questions about how the coronavirus has affected different parts of the globe. From Hong Kong, you've also been following things in Singapore, which at first had an experience similar to Hong Kong. Well, what are they seeing now?
Yeah, Singapore had been one of the global success stories. It was pointed out by people at the WHO as one of the places that people should be looking to. They also kept many businesses open. Churches continued to be, you know, hold services. Even schools, they were very proud of the fact that they had not shut down schools until last week. Last week, they saw a huge spike in cases, nearly 1,000 cases last week, pushing their total for this entire outbreak up to about 3,000. But they had taken very similar aggressive contact tracing measures as Hong Kong. They would use the police, actually, to track cases. They were using mobile apps. They were using antibody tests to actually try to link different clusters of cases that they had found. They were basically throwing everything at it. And they had been able to keep much of their country open. And as I said, their schools, which they were very proud of. But this last week, things have gotten really bad. They had some dormitories where it just spread like wildfire, hundreds of cases in these dormitories, and now they're having to really clamp down.
All right, let's go to a listener question here.
Hi, this is Kelly Huffman from Seattle, Washington. Can the novel coronavirus survive the warmer months? It's summer now in the Southern Hemisphere, and there are cases of COVID-19 in Australia and South America. What does this mean?
Jason, you've been looking into this. What have you found?
So this is a very interesting question, and lots of people want to know the answer to this. And scientists are still not in complete agreement about what the answer is. Let me just lay out what the idea is. There are other coronaviruses that are part of the common cold that we get on a seasonal basis, like influenza. These coronaviruses are not influenza viruses. They're a different virus. Mm-hmm. But also the flu virus, the influenza virus, comes in this seasonal pattern. And one of the big factors is that in the winter, in the cold weather, the temperature, the air is less humid. It's got less water in it. And in that air, when somebody coughs, a little particle comes out. And if the air is incredibly dry, that particle, if it's a small enough particle, all of the water vapor in it can just evaporate in the air. And that particle, that virus particle, can just then continue and is much more airborne. Hmm. If the air is wet, that particle comes out, it gets hit to this wet air, and it drops in front of the person about 6 feet away, and you get less transmission when the air is wet and humid in the summer months. So that is what's happened with the regular influenza virus, with some of these other coronaviruses. So the question is that what's going to happen with this one? Again, they're not sure whether the particles that are being just basically sneezed and coughed out into the air are going to do that. It is true that we are seeing the worst outbreaks. Wuhan, there's snow on the ground when Wuhan got hit. You've got Italy. It was cold when Italy had its worst thing. You had New York when it was still fairly cold. So there does seem to be something when you're looking at the world. Yes, mm-hmm. Some of the worst outbreaks are there. The other big issue, however, they're saying with a new virus like this is that there's so much there's so many people who don't have immunity that could trump that. Yeah.
All right. NPR's Jason Beaubien, thank you for answering these listener questions for us.
You're welcome.
You can send us your questions at npr.org/nationalconversation or on Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. And this is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. We're flooded with information about the coronavirus, and not all of it is solid. Sometimes there are no right answers. Well, Dr. Tina Chopra is back with us again to help us think through some of the difficult choices that everybody has to make these days. She's a professor of infectious diseases at Wayne State University and corporate medical director of infection prevention and hospital epidemiology at the Detroit Medical Center. Dr. Chopra, good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
We have a question from Heather Rose in Minneapolis. Let's listen.
I have a question about bringing my college student back from campus. She's fairly local, but she still does have different exposure circles from her family.
And we actually have Heather on the line with us now to explain a bit more about her situation. Hi, Heather. Oh, Heather, do we have you there? Oh, it seems like we might not have Heather on the line after all. So I understand she has a stepdaughter in college, and she would like for her to come back home. What concerns should Heather address before inviting her college student back into the fold?
I think the first important thing that Heather should ask her stepdaughter is how she's feeling, if she has any symptoms. And the second question is, if she's been exposed to somebody who had any symptoms or tested positive or was sick around her. And the third thing is, when she comes home, what is the situation at her home, at Heather's place, if she has any high-risk individuals at home, including older adults or people who are immunocompromised. And I think if all of the answer depends on all of these three factors. If any of them is there, then definitely, you know, she must maintain social distancing and must not move into a household where there are high-risk individuals present.
Would it make a difference if she is living in a group house or a dormitory or, working a job or self-isolating, those sorts of things?
Yeah, I mean, if she's in an environment where she could have had multiple exposures and she thinks that she may be exposed to someone who's sick, you know, then she's obviously at high risk and she may not even have symptoms or milder symptoms and may be shedding the virus. So all of those things will put her at high risk for exposing other people.
Okay, we have a question now from Pamela in your state, Michigan.
A lot of us here in Metro Detroit are seeing this hotspot growing, and some of us have places up north, as they say, lake houses or small cottages that are more isolated. And I know for myself, I've got that I want to run up north feeling quite a bit. But I don't know if that's really a solution or if that is just spreading the problem further north.
Dr. Chopra, what would you tell Pamela? It's an understandable instinct to try to escape one of these hotspots to someplace more rural, but does that potentially do more harm than good?
Yeah, I think you should stay where you are. And traveling is what our governor has. The stay-at-home orders mean that you don't want to travel and you don't want to mingle with anybody, including the local travel up north. Yes, Detroit is a hotspot, but as long as you are restricted to your home and you are not mingling with anybody else and maintaining social distancing, you are going to be in a same situation as you would be anywhere else. So I would not indulge in traveling and getting out of the house and sitting in a car and increasing your risk of exposure.
Well, if you have a question for Dr. Chopra, send it to us at npr.org/nationalconversation or share it on Twitter using the hashtag NPRConversation. And this next question comes from Maria in Arizona, who is married to someone working on the front lines.
My husband is a first responder. He is one of the lucky with sufficient PPE. However, in the van pool he takes to work, 3 to 7 individuals ride up to 3 hours a day. I appreciate his honesty in stating that they are not wearing masks or bandanas during the rides. I understand my locus of control cannot extend beyond sharing my desire that he wear a face cover. Can you give me your opinion about the danger and what others in van pool situations should do?
Well, first, we want to thank Maria's husband for doing the work that he is doing there on the front lines. And Dr. Chopra is somebody who is also in a hospital setting where there is COVID-19. What advice can you give to Maria about this van pool that her husband is in?
Absolutely, Maria. You know, thank you again to you and your husband for being a hero. I think it's whenever you are in a closed environment and you are sharing a closed space, it's very, very important. And the other individuals, yes, your husband is wearing his PPE, but other individuals in the van should also be wearing PPE, and they should be provided as first line responders the PPE they deserve. They are like warriors who are going for a war and they need their ammunition. So I think that's extremely important. And that is the best advice I can give. And at this point, CDC wants every one of us to have some sort of cover on our face in the form of a mask or a bandana when we are even going out for grocery shopping or any essential things that we need from outside. So definitely cover yourself.
Dr. Tina Chopra, thank you for answering all of these listener questions, and I hope that you also keep safe and healthy during this challenging time. Thank you for the work that you are doing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good luck.
She's a professor of infectious diseases at Wayne State University. We have some good news to end the program tonight. On Valentine's Day, our friends at NPR published a Tiny Desk concert by the Jonathan Scales Forkestra. That's bandleader Jonathan Scales on the steel pans. A month later, Jonathan felt sick. He tested positive for COVID-19. He remained sick for 2 weeks, and then he got better.
Coming out of that into a world where all quarantined and all the concerts are canceled and things like that, I kind of went into a depression for about a week or so. And honestly, it wasn't the music that got me out of the depression, but it was really the support from the fans and everyone around the world who really kind of reminded me that we're all here together.
Jonathan knows that many others have not been as fortunate, and today he told us that this experience has taught him a lesson.
Recovering from coronavirus kind of helped me to just remember to take life day by day. So I'm going to try to remember that well into the future.
Jonathan Scales, we are so glad you're feeling better, and we look forward to hearing many more years of music from you. I'm Ari Shapiro. My co-host Scott Simon will be here tomorrow to answer more of your questions. Send them to us at npr.org/nationalconversation or tweet us with the hashtag NPRConversation. Have a great night. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.